You're on Groove 107.7 FM, and today we're talking to former radio personality, news anchorman for TV3 and other stations, and foreign correspondent and now author Mike McRoberts. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's nice to be here.
Yeah. Well, now the reason we're talking to you is because you've written a book called Beyond the Front Line, which sounds like you're sticking your head over the parapet on this one.
Is a very dangerous thing to do in New Zealand, of course.
Of course. So this is a book about your travels, mostly in television, I gather.
Yeah. I've been asked over the years to think about a biography, but to be honest, I just thought, you know, one, I'm too young, and two, you know, I still had a career ahead of me. But HarperCollins came to me at the end of last year, and their idea was to tell some of the stories behind the stories of the past decade. Of course, it's been a massive decade in terms of news.
Well, yes.
With the war on terror and with, you know, so many natural disasters and that kind of thing. And so it's really post 9/11, but of course I've been lucky enough and privileged enough to be at many of those events, and so that's what the book's about.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on a point. The first chapter pretty much throws you straight into the Christchurch earthquake, which is close to you, coming from that area.
Yeah.
I thought it was rather interesting that there you and John Campbell are, and you're literally wandering around on the ground trying to scrape together crew and so forth. You find the only available plane, you get yourself down there. It must have been strange, though, this kind of otherworldliness, looking at a disaster situation that normally you would be coming in and being totally separated from it, and there you are, and you know everybody, you know everything, you can feel it.
Yeah, look, I mean, you've got it absolutely right, and it was unworldly. It did seem completely unreal, and I'd only just signed the contract to do the book, actually, like I think the week before that February earthquake. And so then, bang, that happened, and we're down there. And yeah, I mean, I think I make the point of the book. You know, I've been all around the world, and often I'm asked about, you know, how I can kind of switch off when I get back to New Zealand and carry on a normal life. But in the past, that had been quite easy because, you know, they were two different worlds. But here I was in, you know, my hometown, you know, scrambling around trying to find out if my family were okay and that kind of thing. And also to do my job as a reporter, and it was pretty tough. It was quite an emotional time, but I think, you know, I think when I look back on our coverage, and I think all the media did a great job, but I specifically think that TV3 did very well with that.
Yeah, certainly. Although we have to give big ups to Jane Bowron, who's writing from her garage still.
Well, this, you know, pretty amazing stories that have come from there, and it was just a crazy time. And I don't think even given the year that we've had, which has just been unbelievable and the most incredible news year that I think I can remember in 25 years as a reporter, but yeah, I hope, and touch wood, we don't see another event like the Christchurch earthquake in February in New Zealand again, because it's just, you know, it's just incredibly difficult for the entire country when you lose that number of people and have that huge of an effect on just not only the local population but the country as a whole.
Yeah, certainly. Just winding back a little bit, there's a great chapter in there. I guess I could put it down to your cult of personality for a newsreader to some degree. I just wanted to know, why is it that TV channels just, they seem to work so hard to create their premier brands around the news and the news readers? Why aren't they developing those around the more in-depth political programs that we used to have? I guess I'm thinking back to Brian Edwards' day, which is unfair, but Channel 7 do it. Why is it always around the soundbite, news at 6 type thing?
Well, so why is the emphasis on news rather than longer form current affairs?
Yeah.
Well, for TV3, that's certainly our most successful brand, and I guess you could argue that, you know, one becomes the other, but the news for us, the 6 o'clock news, is our highest rating show. It beats most things, well, maybe apart from the X Factor on Fridays. But but it is the time that our you know, that our channel engages with New Zealand population. And that is a thing with news, I guess. Look, I'm a huge I'm a huge fan of longer form current affairs. I've stayed doing 60 minutes since taking over the full time newsreading role because I wanted to keep my hand in current affairs. And if there was a public broadcaster as such in New Zealand in television, then I'd seriously look at working for them. I mean, it's more the sort of style that I enjoy as a viewer, and certainly as a journalist as well. But that's just not the commercial. This is not commercially viable, or at least that's what we're told anyway. In New Zealand, I mean, you look at programs like The Nation or Q&A, and as worthy as they are, they just don't rate. I mean, and yes, they're put on a Saturday or a Sunday morning, but you know, from a nightly current affairs perspective, I know John Campbell works incredibly hard to make politics interesting and to keep an audience. But the reality is, you know, you put a politician onto the telly, and even at this time in a build up to an election, and you can almost hear the remote switching over.
Yeah, it's funny that, although you know, national radio still has the highest ratings of any radio station in the country per capita, and that's on any given time. Which interests me. It's even focus on politics, the program itself. There's no switching off going on there. At least we don't know that, but they're guessing that.
That's true, but it's still, you know, while it might have the highest percentage, it's a low percentage if you consider, a national perspective. You know, what are we talking about, 10, 12, maybe 13%? That's not, you know, that's not enough to sustain a television channel. And TV did the same. I mean, they've ditched the charter this year, and are now a commercial broadcaster. I mean, would I prefer if we had a paid for state broadcaster in this country? Absolutely.
That's true. So one of the things that I find quite fascinating is you've gone from newsreader, radio personality with a sports background to some degree, and then you're flying into the most dangerous countries in the world to report and be shot at.
Well,
are you crazy?
in terms of the sport background, I did sport on television for 3 years and was the All Black reporter, so you know, I got to travel a lot, I guess. And
under the guise of Clint Brown, by the way.
and that gave me an idea of what it's like to travel around and that kind of thing, although quite different to obviously covering conflicts. But one of the things about sports broadcasters is that you do tend to build up a lot of skills, and you know, that's live work and being able to report and that kind of thing, and the whole travelling thing and working in a smaller team. I mean, if you look at the news broadcasters around at the moment, Peter Williams did sports for many years. You know, Bernardine Oliver Kirby was a sports reporter. They tend to be, you know, kind of quite good broadcasters, you know, without sounding too immodest. But yeah, I spent 3 years in sport, but then I spent another 3 years on the Holmes program working in current affairs. And it was only at the end of that run that I started getting into. I went over to cover the Fiji coup in 2000. Then, you know, in 2001, went to TV3, and that's where things changed kind of dramatically. But it was very much in a news and current affairs role rather than sport at that stage. And So I mean, those are the opportunities that I was given, and the opportunities that I gratefully accepted.
Yeah, and some of these have turned into some. I guess you've sort of been on the lines there, like the one in Gaza where you're reporting back, and it actually changed Israel's mind, I guess, on what they were doing there. Not you personally, but the presence of the media.
Yeah, I mean, it's journalism in its most noble form, isn't it? When you are able to travel somewhere and make a public aware of what is happening, whether that be indiscriminate shelling of women and children or innocents, or whether it be some other major wrongdoing, if you can bring that sort of international pressure to bear on the warring parties to at least get a ceasefire or whatever, then you know, it's a great result. And I remember I talk in the book about going to Gaza in 2009 when Israel and Hamas were, you know, sort of fighting, and there were rockets being fired at Israel, and Israel had responded, you know, quite heavily. And I sent my children down to tell them what I was doing and why I was going over there, and, you know, with, you know, doing stories like other international media, if we did enough stories and brought the pressure to bear on the government, that hopefully we'd get a ceasefire. Well, as it turned out, about two or three days after I arrived, I'd only done a couple of reports. That's exactly what happened. There was a ceasefire. And I remember ringing home and my then 9-year-old son being very excited and saying, "Dad, you did it." Single-handedly, but, you know, that's one of the great things about being a journalist is going to someone, something like that, and witnessing it firsthand and telling it firsthand and getting the response and the reception and the reaction that you get from those sorts of stories.
Well, so it must be, which leads nicely on to the other question I had, which is about parachute journalism.
Doing incredibly well, I think, Tim.
Well, it's about parachute journalism, and of course this one comes, I mean, you fly into somewhere like China where a school loses 800 people, sounding like Mr. Campbell on these ones, what do you do?
Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah.
Absolutely shocking, you know. But look, I've got no issue with being a parachute journalist. I know some people have, but the reality is just about everybody is a parachute journalist these days, even the major networks like the BBC. I mean, I'm sitting on a plane next to Elise Doucette flying into, I can't even remember what it was now, Jordan. But everyone has parachute journalism to a degree, and it's changed over the years. I mean, we've got access to information and we've got access to contacts and that kind of thing. There's no reason why you can't get there and be pretty schooled up on what is happening. We snuck into China because we didn't want to have to wait for a visa or have a government official with us. And so we went through Shanghai as tourists. Just had a little camera and a BGAN sat phone, which we were feeding our stuff back on. And then we flew domestically to Chengdu, and then drove up to the earthquake stricken regions. And, you know, it was amazing. We were one of about a handful of foreign journalists there, and it was pretty raw, pretty terrible, actually. As you know, a number of schools were collapsed, and so many children were killed. And in one particular school, we were outside of, there were about 800 kids were killed, and it was just, you know, it was a shocking, horrible, grief-stricken place to be, but it was a very compelling story too, of course.
Well, of course, yes, and there are other stories where I guess there's a fine line between being a journalist who's reporting and, of course, that thing that anthropologists talk about, where is that interfering. You took a child to hospital, and there was a big criticism about that.
Yeah, that was in Haiti.
Yeah.
In the start of 2010. Look, you know, I mean, I was criticised about that, but I have absolutely no regrets about that either. I sort of defy anyone to be in that situation and not to have done what I did, which was basically just to take her to hospital. And sure, I carried her around and made sure she got treated, and perhaps might have influenced, the quickness of her treatment, but
because of the presence of the camera.
Again, I don't have too many regrets about that. It's just, I think, and then I was criticised too for doing a story on it, but I thought it made a really compelling story, in that, if we hadn't have been there, what would have happened to her, and how many other children were in a similar situation, other camps, and just, I think it showed very well the hopelessness of the situation there. We had, the media were there, but the aid workers still hadn't arrived, and the medical facilities still hadn't arrived, and the soldiers still hadn't arrived, and what on earth was going on? And and if the same thing had happened the next day, I think I would have done exactly the same. I probably just wouldn't have bothered to make a story of it, because I'd already told that story.
Which is interesting. Peter Dunne is one of the ones who's referred to you as vultures of some degree, sort of swooping in on the carcass before it rots, which is a bit unfair to some degree. I had a go at you when you flew into Christchurch. Of course, he didn't realise you're actually from there. But, you know, that's that. By the by, it is interesting that the media are often there before the before organisations can get there on the ground. Of course, they have logistical issues which are massive. You guys are one on one. You can slip in. You can tramp over the hills, all that sort of thing. But do you actually get back to finding out more about those stories later? Do you get the opportunity to go back and report again and again? Or do you just cut?
Not as often as I'd like, but you know, in the situation of Christchurch, of course, we've been back there numerous times, and you know, John Campbell in particular has made it quite a campaign on his show, I think. We've got reporters in Christchurch who have, you know, like Hamish Clark and Jeff Hampton and others who have done a magnificent job down there. The thing with that, you know, I mean, it's we go there when it's breaking news because I think there's almost a public expectation of it. I mean, if we'd sat in the studio, when Christchurch was unfolding, I mean, there's just no sense in that at all. You know, I mean, if I travel around the world to tell these sorts of stories, why wouldn't I be doing it in Christchurch, or you know, or at the arena in Mount Maunganui, or you know, that terrible canyoning disaster a few years back. There's no sense in that at all. I mean, people do expect us to be there. They expect the news to be a lot more current, and they expect it to be, you know, given to them as it's happening. You know, it's the whole way that television news is done now has changed dramatically in just the past year. You know, from that first earthquake in September through to Pike River, you know, the breaking into local content, and then, you know, with Christchurch, where it just dominated the news and general television for weeks.
Yeah, the only thing is I'm just wondering about this. With these ones, it's okay because they are local and there's plenty of journalists on the ground. But some of those stories like Haiti and ones like that, they seem to have drifted off a bit.
Oh, right, sure.
And we lose focus on those things. And until somebody, you know, sticks a can under your nose with raising money or something, you really aren't aware of them. They've just gone away. The next disaster's come and gone and so forth. But I was also just getting back to your point before. There's two journalists of the most extreme ends, Nikki Hager and Joe Karam, who have obviously done a lot of deep research into things, and they've influenced things, maybe Ian Wishart as well to a degree. They've influenced the way that we that stories have become issues, and people have dealt with those things. Have you had any examples of that apart from the Gaza one?
Yeah, I have. I've had a colleague of mine and you know, a guy that I call a good friend, John Stevenson, of course, you know, came up with quite an amazing story at the beginning of this year about what our SAS were and weren't doing in Afghanistan, and was roundly rubbished for it. In fact, you know, the Prime Minister called him, what was it, unreliable or with no credibility, or something like that. It was quite, it was quite personal and really completely unwarranted. Because, you know, as it turned out, as we've seen with Nikki's book, and also with the Defence Force's own revelations in the months since, that he was absolutely right with the story that he did. And you know, I really take my hat off to those journalists. And you're right. I mean, you know, you couldn't get, you know, sort of further extremes in Nikki Hager and Joe Karam, but the work that they put into those investigations, and sometimes the little bounce that they get out of it, you know, it's really disturbing. You kind of wonder. So many of these issues seem to be so easily shut down, and that's the biggest concern for me in news at the moment, to be honest.
So is that because there's a bigger, a higher power involved? I mean,
the government says it isn't a story, and that's that. And it's terrible. I mean, unless you want to keep pushing, and I know that John has. I'm talking about John Stevenson here. I mean, there's just no, you know, it can be very, very difficult.
Do you also get, I guess you must get some editorial pressure perhaps from the channel itself, you're saying don't touch this. I mean, there's always an argument about whether sponsors are involved or, you know, that the company that owns the company is playing a part. Or do you worry about that? Or?
Look, I can honestly put my hand on the heart and say that that has never been an issue at TV3. You know, we guard our independability and independence fiercely. You know, we did run with John's story. I did a 60 Minutes piece on it. We ran it on the news and subsequently, you know, had complaints against us from the Defence Force. But
well, you know, it's good then.
survived, you know, yeah. And those complaints, you know, were never upheld. In fact, were never formally processed. So, you know, that's a good thing. I mean, you know, I'd be really concerned if there was any kind of editorial influence coming our way other than the, you know, head of news and current affairs or our producers/editors.
That's a good thing to know on that side. Okay, let's get a little bit more gritty just for a moment here. I need to know about Afghanistan. I need to know about that there's a great photo in the book of you returning to the base camp and there's a cliff on either side.
Right.
That looks like something straight out of Tintin. There's a famous scene.
Isn't it? That's in northern Bamiyan. And they're called the Pillars of Hercules, and it's...
I believe it.
Yeah, and it really is. I mean, it's a great photo, but as you can imagine, being there, it's just, you know, it's just jaw-dropping. And the New Zealand base, which is a remote base, is called Remero, and that's just past the Pillars of Hercules. And yeah, it was an extraordinary situation. We travelled up there and spent a couple of days up with Kiwi 2 Patrol, and their job was, you know, the most difficult at that stage, and that was out patrolling that sort of northern area, which is where we've had difficulties, and indeed that where Lieutenant Tim O'Donnell was killed 80 months later. So yeah, pretty astonishing scenery and amazing place.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of different stories from what the troops are actually doing up there, and I must defend Nicky Hager to a degree because I talked to him and he said that the American influence was a very, very small part of his book when he was talking about those things. But since then, there's been a lot of controversy about what they're actually doing up there. What was your experience?
Well, I was based solely with the reconstruction team. So at that stage, the SAS weren't in Kabul, and the reconstruction team are doing a variety of projects. Really, at that it's keeping the roads safe. It's, you know, it's they're doing a little bit of community work with helping out with hydro dams and things like that. But it was very much a peacekeeping role. And, you know, we've had a number of men and women from our Defence Force go through there. I mean, it's just staggering. And we've been there for 10 years now. That's longer than the First and Second World Wars combined. It's just, amazing. But I thought they were doing a good job. I found it a really strange experience because I'd never been embedded before. And, you know, driving around Kabul in a Humvee with the Defence Force, you should feel quite protected. But in actual fact, I don't think I've ever felt more of a target than travelling around in a Humvee in Kabul, because, you know, that stage...
You stand out.
Still, you know, you're seeing military patrols being targeted.
Yeah, it fascinated me. It's come up a couple of times in the various press releases that I've read about your book, and also in the book itself. The market where all... Anything can be made for you. I mean, the idea that somebody can make an anti-tank gun is just amazing.
Yeah. Well, that was that's actually, yeah, it's on the Pakistan side of the border, so it's not far from the Khyber Pass, and it was a village which has been shut down now. But we were there in 2001, and yeah, you could get anything you wanted, you know, if you had the right money, and it was just extraordinary. Presumably, you know, they were well made. I mean, we didn't buy anything, but they're pretty resourceful.
Yeah, I always remember a Billy Connolly joke about him saying, you know, if you the best job in the world must be a nuclear bomb salesman, because you can't exactly go out into the car park and test it out. Kind of get that same feeling for this one. So, okay, so you're packing for an overseas trip, and what goes in there apart from the beige shirt? Lot of opposition when you walk off the plane with TV gear and they say, whoa, what's going on here?
It's not too bad. I mean, we're normally going to, you know, to a situation where there are other cameras as well, so, you know, because it's a breaking story. There have been times when, and my cameraman that I normally use is from Wellington, actually. His name's Michael Lacoste, although everyone calls him Dutchie. And he's had his tapes taken off him a couple of times. I think the first time might have been in 2001 when we were driving to that to Peshawar, Pakistan. But generally speaking, you know, and of course now we have had a couple of situations where we've gone into countries like Zimbabwe or China or Burma, and not as television reporters but as tourists. So you sort of kind of bending the rules have been going and is going in undercover.
As tourists.
And so we've scaled things down even further and have, you know, got smaller cameras and, you know, much sneakier ways of getting pictures out.
Yeah, that just raises another question on the side is how do you feel your role is generally, or the foreign correspondent's role is generally, as a reporter, when there's so much social media that is, well, faster than you are?
It's faster, but it's not always reliable. In fact, quite often, you know, there's been two or three glaring examples in the past year where you know, things have been said on Twitter, like a, you know, Qantas plane going down in Indonesia and things like that, which have turned out to be completely false. And when you're in the business of pictures, it's a different story, I think. You know, I think, you know, I get asked this a lot in the context of where television might be heading in terms of, you know, like, will I still have a job in 10 years and that sort of thing with new media and online and that kind of thing. I can't specifically say what the platform will be, but I think there will always be the demand for the content. And for us, it's always been the storytelling. And so that's, you know, that's the difference rather than going and standing on a hotel roof in Baghdad, actually getting out and producing stories, finding out what's going on, and I think there will always be a demand for that.
Well, there certainly was. I know that with Christchurch, for example, the first thing that went on was the internet. The second thing was the television, and the third thing was the radio. Ironically, because radio was more immediate, but you know, there's no scheduling to worry about there. But this seems to be the way that it's working, at least in our household, anyway.
Quite amazing, though. I quite often tweet, and so does Hilary Barry, my co-presenter, during the news, and it's been quite a revelation in the last year, just because people can give you instant feedback on, you know, on whatever story you might be running, or even the order of the stories, and it's been quite telling. And sometimes it's funny, and sometimes it's, you know, and sometimes it's quite abusive. But at least you're getting an idea, although probably skewed if, you know, it's on Twitter. But it's just been an interesting way to get immediate feedback, which we've never been able to do before with television.
Good thing to check if your lunch is not in your teeth too.
I quite often get told that's not the right tie.
Well, that's probably not your choice though. Good old wardrobe. Mike, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Your book is called Beyond the Front Line. Now, you're down in Wellington on Saturday.
Yep, I'm actually down on Friday night. I'm speaking at the Wellington Free Ambulance dinner, which will be amazing. It'll be fantastic. And then on Saturday, yes, we're around at about a few shops in Wellington, then also up to the Kapiti Coast, which will be great.
Yes, indeed. So you're signing at Bennett's Bookshop in Wellington, Lamp to Key at 10 o'clock, 11:30 out at Paper Plus in Lower Hutts, and at 1 to 1:30 out at Paper Plus in Coastland. So we'll look forward to seeing you there.
Wonderful. Great. Thank you very much for the interview. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. Just stay on the line a moment. Yeah. That was Mike McRoberts, and his book is called Beyond the Frontline.